Ryan, our regular book reviewer, managing director at Gateways Business Consultants. Possibly one of the more interesting startups of the last decade and a bit has been this huge revolution in the way in which we consume visual content, or television as it used to be called, Ian Mann. And it's all down to a guy called Reed Hastings, who started something called Netflix.
I think it's even more spectacular than that. If you just think of it this way, Bruce, in the last 17 years since it's gone public, the share price has risen from $1 to $350 in 17 years. Over exactly the same period, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ grew in equivalent from $1 to $3 to $4. And it's spectacular. Now, if that isn't impressive enough, there's a survey that they do in the United States about the happiness of your employees. Are your employees happy? Is it a nice place to be? 45,000 very large U.S. companies joined in that survey. Netflix was rated number two. What they do is quite spectacular, and it's quite counterintuitive. What they've done is they've used the culture that they have to make them into a fantastic business. Sorry, just a disclaimer. I generally don't recommend that medium-sized, even more or less large South African businesses bother reading anything about great companies in order to learn anything. I think that great companies, whether it's iTunes or anything else, is so different from the sort of companies that we know that you probably shouldn't waste your time. They have nothing to say to you. So only book I've ever read that I can say unequivocally is important is this particular one, and for one reason. Their success has been because of how they manage the business itself, not the strategies that they've taken, but how they manage the business itself, what I would call the functional strategy. And they've got a three-part functional strategy. They work on it, and because of that, they become extraordinarily, extraordinarily successful at being innovative. And that's what it is. I think that's why this is such a firm, such an important book.
I mean, talk to me about those strategies. I mean, not the strategies, about the way they manage the business. Yeah.
Yes. Let me tell you what it is. They believe in three things. One is they believe in what they call talent density. You have got to have absolutely superb people on your team, bar none, nothing. That's it. Now, when you do that, you can have a couple of the other things. There are three parts. The first one is talent density. The second one is real candor. And the third one is remove controls. The only reason why we have controls in businesses and checks and balances is because you've got people in your company whose work is sloppy, who are unprofessional, who are irresponsible. And because there are people like that, we put in lots and lots and lots of controls. The only way you can have a company that wants to remove as many controls as it possibly can is Netflix, and it happens because they believe in having really, really dense talent. If you were to work at a company and the company is just full of super bright people who are incredibly productive, you'd want to be there. So what they do is they say, if we find that somebody is not a first class performer, like best of breed, but he's a really hardworking human being, what we do is we give him a very, very generous severance package. What they're looking for is only people extraordinarily good. If, of course, you are sloppy or irresponsible, you'll be shown the way out without a package. They don't believe, for example, in putting people on performance improvement programs for two good reasons. Good reason number one is it's expensive because somebody else has to monitor them, and it's wasting somebody else's time. The second reason is that in the 3 or 4 months that it takes to bring this person up from a sloppy performer up to a reasonably good performer, you could have had yourself a great performer who'd really add real value to your company. So what they do is they would assist the person to leave as fast as they can, and if necessary, pay them a severance package so they don't land up in court. The second part of their talent density is they believe that, remember, this is a company that people are extraordinarily happy in. They say, we are not a family. In a family, you protect and you cover up for the weaknesses of people. That's what families do. We protect and cover. He says, we're not a family. We're a team. And in a sports team, you drop the weakest people on the team And you're always trading players. And the reason for that is you just want people to be the best. And that's what their talent density. They're obsessed with that.
It's so interesting. I love this idea of talent density because you've got people, and it's, I mean, many South African executives have said they've done similar things. People like Michael Jordan, when he turned around FNB and said, you know what, you've got to hire people who are smarter than you at what they do. And your job is to make sure that they all work together and they work in concert. And so it's a similar idea of talent density, except he gives it a cooler name. And then King Price Insurance, for example, at the end of the first month of employment, if you want to leave, they'll pay you to leave. They'll give you an extra month's salary, and no hard feelings. You don't fit in, so please leave before you're unhappy and you make everybody else around you unhappy and you drag us into the gutter of your morosity with you. Rather, let's just call it quits. Nobody, you know, we both made a mistake. You weren't meant to be here. We shouldn't have hired you. You shouldn't have come here. So I tell you what, let's not make it difficult for you to leave. Let's help you. And that is such a wonderful way of working, I think. And I mean, they've got the budgets to do it.
I think that they have the budget to do it because they have always had this as a policy from when they really didn't have any budget. From when they talked about how he first, when they were very small and they just didn't have enough money, they had to get rid of staff. And they sat down, him and his HR lady, they sat down and they said, here are all the names of the guys. Who is a keeper and who can we afford to lose? So they started using the word keepers. A keeper is somebody you say, I will do anything to keep this person. Still today, that's a key part of what they do. Everybody wants to be a keeper. Because, in fact, they encourage their staff to find out what they're paying for a position like yours elsewhere. So when the headhunter's phone, they don't sneak off into the corner. They say, speak loud, tell him, ask him, how much could you earn in somebody else's company? And they come and tell us. And if you're a keeper, we'll pay you more than that. So we don't want you to discover that you happen to be very valuable. If you're very valuable, we'll pay for it. And he says, we don't have money to pay for it. We'll look around who else can go because keeping you will make the company so much richer. And they've got, it's a very, very interesting perspective. Now, the part of that, this keeping the talent up, is an obsession with candor. When they talk about the basic idea of candor is that smart people have got a lot of smart things to say to other people. And they see it almost as an act of disloyalty when you hold back and don't speak up. Just understand this. You disagree with a colleague and you don't speak up. That's disloyal. Because if you believed in this company and you're paid by this company, you tell us everything. You see, this stuff works in cycles. You first start a little bit light, you get do all these different, these three things at different levels of intensity. But if you want to start off this idea of candor, how about having the CEO and everybody beneath it modeling it? And the model would look something like this. You're in a meeting. You just joined the company and you, as a senior guy, saying something and a junior guy says, no, you're talking nonsense. It really, really isn't like that. And he says, no, it is. He says, no, I can tell you that's nonsense. And there's a whole argument going on there about this, whether the argument is, whether the senior person is correct or the junior person is correct. At the end of the meeting, the senior person says, hey, mate, I want to thank you a lot. You really raised the debate in this meeting. Now, when you have that type of approach to getting feedback, and you also have the threat behind you that if I'm not the best that there is, I will not be a keeper. People are quite serious about candor, and people are quite serious about being candid with others and taking as much criticism as they can. There's a couple of rules for candor. Rule number one for candor is that it's not personal. It's aimed at the project. The second thing is it doesn't recognize rank. And the third part is it has to be actionable. So it's not personal, it doesn't recognize rank, and it's actionable. So if I said to you, now, Bruce, you are absolutely terrific, you're not allowed to say that. Because what are you supposed to do if somebody tells you you're terrific? So the whole approach to candor is trying to get each other to be better than they were before.
Let's get there in just a second. I mean, this idea of candor, I mean, I just look at so many South African businesses, and very many South African businesses are built on this idea of we are family. We're together. We've lost a member of the family. They've lost a member of the team or whatever the case might be. We're very emotional about the way we do business. And we're not honest with each other. We're not frank with each other because we don't want to offend. Because, you know, you don't want to hurt somebody's feelings because you'll have to work with them again tomorrow. And if they're feeling sulky and hurt and wounded, well, you know, it becomes a lousy place to work. So, you know, people tiptoe around each other all the time. And it makes for, as you say, actually a dishonest workplace and an underperforming workplace, ultimately.
And ultimately, if I want to be a keeper, I must encourage you. When you say to me, you know, you talk far too much and you talk far too fast and you talk far too loudly in meetings. And I say, is that true? And you say, yes, it is true. And you can ask anybody else, it's true. And that irritates us. And I would be very pleased to know that, because the last thing I want to do is being one of those people who people feel is disruptive and not a contributor. And then I won't be a keeper. So if anybody better than me happens to be around, I'm going to be dropped off the team. It's a very interesting way of dealing with we tend not to be candid, and we haven't built a culture around candor. Mm-hmm. The last thing I just want to throw in is the third part is to remove controls. So, for example, if you want a vacation, take it. If you want to fly first class, fly. The only rule is, and by the way, it applies to everything. So the only rule is there are no restrictions. There's no policies, there's no procedures. You have to ask permission from everybody. The only rule is that you have to act in the best interest of the company. So if you got on the plane and you took yourself a first-class ticket, and somebody says, why did you fly first? You say, oh, I just enjoy it, it's lovely. You'll be shown the door rather quickly. If you said, I flew first because we arrive at 5 in the morning, and by the time I get to the hotel, it'll be 6:30, clean up at 7:30, and I'm being picked up at 8:00 for an important meeting. I did not want to be in a sloppy state because I wouldn't be able to concentrate. Well, that's in the best interest of the company, so who cares? So whatever you do, you don't ask permission, and you probably, they said, save so much money not having to check up on everybody. And having everybody takes responsibility for what they do. You remove as many controls as you possibly can, and you give people, just to the extent, if you're going to buy the rights to a movie, they described one of the scenes, one of the pieces in the book, it was really a lot of money, $2 million, and somebody had to make a call on that. And he said to his manager, like, well, tell me what to do. Manager said, no, I implore you to work out what to do. Your job is just ask as many people as you possibly can and then just go and do it. Now, the question is, what happens when you fail? There's only one rule in Netflix when you fail. You have to do what they call sunlighting it. When you fail, you pay too much for their movie, you call all people that might be interested in there, say, hi, guys, please come and listen to this. I paid much too much money for this movie. Let me explain to you why. I thought this would happen. I thought that would happen. That was my assumption. That was my prediction. I was wrong on this. I was wrong on that. And I was wrong on that. Say, that's neat. That's insightful. I'm teaching other people, and I'm sharing with them what I learned, as a result of which, you've got people who are becoming more and more intelligent, and nobody's ashamed for making a mistake. The mistake might be, I didn't even ask enough people, I only asked 2 or 3. Don't worry, we all make mistakes, but if you share your mistakes with everyone, we all learn.
It feels very Investec in that respect. I mean, Stephen Kosseff built the culture around Investec. If, you know, if you made a mistake and you did it, though, with the very best interests of the company at heart, and it was a genuine mistake, you made those assumptions and you made a mistake, there was plenty of room for forgiveness. You make the same mistake twice, however, you're out. If you've found a lack of integrity in your decision-making process, you're out, but it much, much quicker. And it is it's a question of having companies that are run by strong peer groups, companies that are run by like-minded and operated by like-minded individuals, quite a homogenous but highly competitive group, all of whom want to win, who are incentivized to win, and are able to tell each other some uncomfortable truths in a way that people don't go and whimper and hide in a corner and become sulky and unproductive for a month, because that helps nobody. I mean, it's a glorious theory. I wonder if there are any South African companies that at least aspire to that. I don't know if you're aware of any.
Let me tell you two things. Thing number one, There was an article in the Huffington Post explaining why Netflix is so good. And they said Netflix is so good because they treat employees as adults. Second thing I think is that if you're only going to read one book this year, in fact, this year and next year, only one book, and you're leading a company or even a part of a company, I would urge you to read this book. I think you'll learn so much from this book that you won't learn from so many other places.
The book is No Rules Rules by Reed Hastings. It's all about what makes Netflix tick. 350 times more valuable in 17 years than when it started, whereas the S&P 500 is up between 3 and 4 times. There is no comparison. Ian Mann from Gateway's Business Consultants, going off to crack the whip and tell some truths in the morning, no doubt, and our regular book reviewer. Thank you, Ian Mann.